Hello, and welcome to the Yale Journal of Biology and Medicine podcast. I'm Shabani Dayal, a second-year master's student at the School of Public Health in the Social and Behavioral Sciences Department. And today we're joined by Dr. Kai Chen. Dr. Chen is an environmental epidemiologist who focuses on the intersection of climate change, air pollution, and human health. His work involves applying multidisciplinary approaches in climate and air pollution sciences, exposure assessment, and environmental epidemiology to investigate how climate change may impact human health. Dr. Chen received his PhD in environmental science and engineering in 2016 from Nanjing University in China, was an Alexander von Humboldt postdoc fellow at German Center for Environmental Health, and joined the Yale School of Public Health faculty in July 2019 as an assistant professor of epidemiology. He also serves as the deputy faculty director and the director of research at the Yale Center on Climate Change and Health. Thank you so much for joining us for this interview today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you. And we're excited to talk about your work on the intersection between climate change, air pollution, and human health.
Thank you for the nice introduction and invitation. I'm very glad to be here.
I just wanted to start by asking a little bit about what brought you to the field that you're in and what brought you to studying climate change and human health. How would you describe your interest in this field?
So I entered this field back when I was an undergraduate in China. You know, when in China at that time, it was severe air pollution problem. So I remember episodes with severe air pollution that was so high-level air pollution that people joke about that if you in that smoke wing, if you pumped out your finger, you couldn't see your finger because it's so sick of air pollution. So that kind of triggers me to find out how bad these air pollution episodes are to human health. So that leads me to epidemiology, why I want to do something on that. And then I quickly find out, you know, air pollution and climate change, basically, they are the two sides of the same coin. Why we're saying that? Because the things that emit air pollution at the same time emits carbon emissions. So then these are really, you know, the same issue. So when we tackle one, we can also tackle another. But problem with air pollution, I still recall my first publication, is when I look at it, air pollutant called ozone, which is a gaseous pollutant. It turns out that when temperature is very high, you also have high ozone problem. And I was wondering whether or not during the summer, during the heat waves, whether the ozone health effect is enhanced by a high temperature. So I did the study, I found out there actually are such a thing we call interaction. So it means the ozone health effect, not only the concentration itself, but its health effects are enhanced during a high temperature. So you see, air pollution and climate change, they are interlinked not only from the source, but their health effects also intermingled. So that's why I'm in this field. That's why I'm doing work on climate change.
Wow, that's really interesting, especially the joke about like reaching out your hand and not being able to see your hand.
Exactly. So if you imagine like last year we have the Wi-Fi smoke, but it's largely here up in the sky is orange. Imagine you were being in that, right? So that could be some of the very severe episodes.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. Your work has focused on all kinds of health impacts that occur from changes in air quality to responses in temperature. And some of your work is focused on heat exposure and cardiovascular health. So we wanted to ask about how you came across this topic of research and what you found or what you chose to investigate.
Yeah, thanks. So when we look at the health effect of temperature, first thing we notice is that the temperature impact on health is really twofold. So when we talk about heat, the high temperature part, it increased mortality risk. And there's also another part when it gets too cold, it also increased mortality risks. And then when we want to dive into why does heat and cold both increase the mortality, you need to look at the cause of the disease. And if we look at the burden of the disease, a majority of the burden comes from cardiovascular disease, especially in developed countries like the U.S. or other major developing countries like China. Cardiovascular disease is a major burden. And in the air pollution field, it turns out, first of all, air pollution can impact respiratory illness, but then they can kind of go to into the body, penetrating into the blood system and circulate, impacting a lot of burden on cardiovascular system. So for the heat as well, we're wondering, could heat also impact cardiovascular system? And there has some evidence showing we do the mortality analysis, go to the cardiovascular mortality, you see there's a consistent evidence showing heat can increase cardiovascular disease mortality, such as heart attack, stroke. So we have multiple evidence of it. But then we want to also look at, does heat can also actually trigger some of these events, like say someone have a heart attack. Is that a heart attack triggered by high temperature? So we want to do something like that. And we, when I was a postdoc in Germany, we had an opportunity to work with a very long years of observation study using what we call a registry that you basically follow up with this, those people for a long period of time, that you register all the cases that you want to study for a long period. So we've been able to look at it, that registry in a small German city called Augsburg that had given us almost 13 years of data. So we could look at all the people living in that city when they have the heart attack. And then we can compare the temperature on the day that they have the heart attack versus some of the, what we call the control days. Usually it's a few days before or after they have the heart attack. As surprisingly, we see the heat can also lead to increased occurrence of these heart attacks. So this is one thing that we have been doing, and we now have more and more evidence, more and more studies showing it's not only about heart. We recently been working on stroke, using some data in the U.S. as well. So I think there's more and more evidence showing heat can lead to increased risk for both cardiovascular disease mortality and morbidity.
That's really, really interesting. And did your findings find any, did you have any reports on the strength of this relationship or maybe who's most at risk?
Yeah, so when we look at it, you know, all the different information, whether or not it's a mortality outcome, a specific morbidity hospitalization or ER with emergency room visits, we, the first thing we notice is there are some differences in age groups. So old adults in general is more vulnerable to heat. That means you, when you look at it, what we call the retro risk for such an association with heat exposure, old adults tend to have a much higher retro risk compared with young adults. And because of that, it has a large public health consequences. So we look at the burden. So old adults contribute more of the heat related mortality and morbidity burden. And because of that, we recently did a global scale study to look at, you know, in the future, we have the warming climate. So whether we reduce the emission by how much carbon emissions or not in the next decade, we're going to have a warming climate. That's unfortunate because the lagging effect of carbon emission warming potential. So what we found out is when the global warming reaches this 1.5, 2, or 3 degrees Celsius targets, in the same time, the world is also aging. U.S. is already aging. The societies like Japan is all already an aging society. China is, India is entering this phase. And in the next decade, two decades, you will see more and more developing countries have more older adults. So the population aging is really another demographic trend cannot not be ignored. And it turns out, because older adults are born, so we really have a kind of dual threat. So warming climate will give us more adverse impacts. Heterogeneous cardiovascular mortality will increase because of warming climate. But in the same time, we'll have more older adults. So that's why aging will kind of amplify the contingent health impacts. So that's one thing we have been working on. The second thing is, it turns out pregnant women, and infants, children, they are also born. So there has been multiple studies to show heat exposure can lead to increased risk for preterm birth, low birth weight, or even some other child growth outcomes. Our recent study actually shows some that not only high temperature, but the temperature kind of variability, the variations within a day or a few days of temperature can also lead to increased risk for infant. So there are more and more brain out as showing the infants, children, and pregnant women are more vulnerable. So these are the things we know for sure. There are also other evidence showing people different kind of occupation bias matters. Imagine, very hot, humid summer day, people are working outside, sugarcane workers, for example. They have high exposure, and because of that, they tend also to have higher risks. So there are more and more evidence of revealing the different aspects of vulnerability. But unfortunately, for the study of heat, it's something that you cannot avoid. So although we have the, you may argue that we have the air conditioning, but there's always time that, you will go outside, work outside. And so it's almost inevitable to face that challenge. And especially in a society, we have at the same time a lot of disparities in health, in the resources, in the income. And another piece of our study is, unfortunately, we found that a lot of low-income communities, low-income families, they have less resources to adapt or reduce their exposure. So as a consequence, they also suffer from high exposure, but also suffer from high risks.
That's really interesting. It's very interesting that you mention both pregnant women, infant birth weight, and also low-income communities. So I would love to talk to you about more about both of those. I wanted to ask about temperature variability and birth weight specifically. What were the conditions that maybe increased the risk of low birth weight, or could you tell us more about that work in general?
Yeah, so that was a kind of project that we worked on, focusing on some of the low-middle income countries. We had a project that was focusing on extreme precipitation events, including flooding, droughts events in some of the major low-middle income countries, using the data from the Demographic Health Service. And while we're doing that, in the same time, we found out, well, temperature also has an impact. So we look at the temperature and temperature variability, and unfortunately we found that significant impacts as well. So the impact is not only supposed to be low birth weight. So the outcome that I mentioned, preterm birth, infant mortality, you also have significant impacts. And the reason why we look at temperature variability is because when we talk about temperature, you might find that it's easy because you can find the temperature record on a phone, right? So we have the temperature reading every day, right? You will read that to decide how much clothes, so what kind of clothes are you going to wear, right? But unfortunately, it's also a complex issue because when we talk about the matrix of temperature, what kind of temperature we are talking about? Are we talking about mean average temperature, daily maximum temperature, minimum temperature? Some people will argue well, you know, it's harder to cool off in the night. So maybe the nighttime temperature is important because if you have, imagine you have a very hot night, you can't sleep and not sleeping well will create a lot of stress, oxidative stress, etc., that leads to cardiovascular disease or other even mental health problems. So, you know, different metrics of temperature matters. But at the same time, the temporal variations that, you know, if you think about in the same day, the daily maximum minus the daily minimum, which we call the diurnal temperature range, could also matter. Because if we have a day that only, let's say, a few degrees of Fahrenheit temperature variation, it's fine. But if we have, for imagine you have a 20 degree Fahrenheit temperature change, I imagine
this was very
cold in the morning and all of a sudden getting very hot and then getting very cold, right? So I, for personally myself, I know I will experience some discomfortness. And we are, relatively speaking, still, you know, in terms of the vulnerability, we're not the most vulnerable subgroups. Imagine the most vulnerable groups when they experience these all of a sudden abrupt large temperature changes. So that will trigger a lot of health impacts. And we see evidence from many studies showing the temperature variability on mortality. So that's why we did a study to look at, okay, among these children, do that impact the low birth weight? And we indeed find out.
Wow, that's really interesting. And that's a relationship that I hadn't previously realized would be connected in that kind of way. Another study that you've done recently talked about the relationship between changes in temperature or climate and children's academic results. And that was a really surprising connection as well. Could you tell us more about what you found there?
Yes. So the reason why we look at it that is because when we think about effects of air pollution and ambient air temperature, the effects really goes beyond the respiratory systems. And we have done a lot of studies, for example, about kidney disease. We saw kidney disease increases. And then recently, there's more and more studies showing air pollution and the heat can also impact brain health. And that brain health leads to either, for older adults, that's, for example, we see air pollution can lead to increased dementia and trigger, maybe contributing to some of the Alzheimer's disease. But for younger adults, we find also maybe they can also impact their cognitive development. So that's why we initiated this study to look at it. In North Carolina, long-term air pollution can actually lower the test scores for both math and reading among children attending public schools. So this is just one piece of evidence, but we are working on something, but many others also showing that heat exposure can also lower students' test scores. And there's other studies also shows, even for college students, during a hot summer, if you don't have air conditioning in your dormitory and you're taking the final exams, unfortunately, that has some significant impact. So indeed, that's why I'm saying the adverse impacts of temperature and air pollution seems like it's to be impacted to all the organ systems, all the full spectrum of disease, which has not been 100% understood yet. So while the mission we embark on is to reveal the true cost, the true health cost of climate change through air pollution, extreme temperature, extreme weather events.
Wow. That's really interesting. And that definitely highlights all of the work that you've done that talks to the fact that the impact of extreme weather events goes beyond just maybe accidental injury or accidental mortality. This also ties into the work that you've done, which is beyond these conditions in like childhood diarrhea or flooding and cause-specific mortality. Could you tell us more about those that work that you've done?
Yes, thanks. So when we think about these events, we call it natural disasters. And as a disaster, we know it causes damages. And when you look at the damages, in the U.S., there's a term called billion-dollar disasters. And in 2023, last year, which is the warmest year on record, the U.S. also has a record-breaking number of billion-dollar disasters, 28 in total. So that was way higher than previous years. And when you look at this billion-dollar disaster, it's $1 billion, it's a lot. But where do these costs come from? Property damages, house insurance, car insurance loss, or property insurance loss. So majority of them is not from house costs. And so that's why we want to look at, okay, for these disaster events, flooding, droughts, hurricanes, they actually has a large hidden house cost that is not a factor in people's mindset about this cost. So we look at first in the demographic health survey in some of the low middle income countries, we found that flooding exposure and drought exposure can have significant increased risk of childhood. And recently we found that flood exposure and drought exposure can also lead to other adverse health impacts. Some of them are under review, so I will not talk more about them. But another thing I want to mention is when we do a lot of these studies, one hypothesized kind of mechanism is, you know, flood and droughts, they would disrupt the water access. We found that in low middle income countries, for poor households that don't have clean water for wash cans or soup to wash your hands, or don't have direct access to clean water, these families tend to have high risks for their children to have a developed childhood diarrhea when exposed to drought and flood. So people will kind of argue that, well, here is in the United States, we have access to clean water. And even during the emergencies, you might even bought a lot of bottled water, right? So maybe that kind of pathway is not that important. And that's probably not many people are looking at the health effect of these events in the U.S. beyond just injuries. Like people, maybe you see from news, people drowning in the basement, or maybe unfortunately hidden by a fallen tree, these kind of accidents. So we see some fatality numbers, but these are severely underestimated because we always say that mortality is, if you look at the full spectrum housing bag, mortality is just tip of the iceberg. So what's hidden below is all the different hospitalization, ER visits, all these things that are not being reviewed. So that's why we want to reveal that and to look at the database. In the particular study we did in North Carolina is that we first look at, are there other causes of deaths that are not recognized by these extreme weather events? So we found that, well, that mortality impact actually goes beyond just this accident. We see non-accidental deaths also increases associated with this flooding exposure. And when we look at what are the increases, cardiovascular disease, like a stroke, and other, surprisingly, mental health-related mortality has a very high increase. So obviously the next step for us is to understand why does this specific cause this, especially cardiovascular disease, morbidity can be associated with flooding and droughts, both worldwide and in the U.S. as well.
Wow, that's so significant. Thank you for sharing that. And when you're talking about the hidden costs, hidden health costs of, for example, climate change and air pollution exposure, you're also talking about potentially mental health outcomes. So what kind of exposures were you looking at, and which disorders do you think were most commonly impacted by or triggered by these exposures?
Yeah, so One thing I start with evolution, because evolution is the field has in the past few decades really going to expand all the organ systems that we know that can be impacted by evolution. So we did some studies in China and the U.S. to show that higher evolution can lead to more outpatient visits and more emergency room visits for mental disorders. And we even find in pregnant women that when they have experienced high air pollution exposure, they will suffer more stress in a cell. So that's what we know for air pollution. And when we look at the temperature, and we're using a whole statewide database in New York State, and we first look at the overall mental health emergency room visits, we found there's significant increase. The high temperature you get, the high risk for mental disorder emergency room visits. Well, we then think about potentially, because mental disorder is such a large category, there's so many different category diseases, like you can have people having substance abuse, how people have schizophrenia, people have mental depression, right? Have very different mechanisms. So we are thinking, okay, maybe heat is affecting them differently. So let's look at the subcategories. And when we look at the subcategories of mental disorders, it turns out this kind of significant, almost a linear association between heat and mental disorder emergency room visits exists in the major category of disease, whether it's depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, substances. These all have significant increases. So that really triggers us to think about maybe there's something common, both mechanism, biological mechanism, but also socially happening that it can trigger increase of mental disorders. So for example, sleep, people don't wear high days, don't sleep well, that may be one mechanism, but we don't know for sure. So that's why more research is needed into help us better understand. We also found something interesting like, is green space going to reduce the risk of mental disorders? Having been close to green space are going to reduce the health, the temperature or air pollution effects on mental disorders? These are some things that we try to investigate right now.
That's really, really interesting. Especially that linear relationship. I don't think that there's a lot of awareness, especially socially, about the ways in which changing temperatures and air pollution can have that impact on mental health and even possibly medical costs. Your work also acknowledged that the impact of changing air quality and changing temperatures disproportionately impacts some communities over others. So some of your research looks at racial and ethnic disparities in heat vulnerability in the U.S., Could you tell us more about what prompted that study and what you found?
Yeah, thanks. So when we talk about climate impacts, heat is the first thing people have in mind. But if you look at the number, how many people died every year in the U.S. because of heat exposure, you might find very inconsistent numbers. For example, the CDC has a number estimating roughly 700 people died per year. And in the same time, we have different groups using different methods, showing completely different numbers. Could it be 10 times, even hundreds of times different? There was a study that as a global scale showing roughly that could be every year globally around 500,000 people died due to heating. So you see different numbers. And in the U.S., unfortunately, we don't have a very, very good number, both nationwide, but also at the community level. So CDC has a very good called heat illnesses, but they have that heat illnesses data only for 10 big HHS regions. It is much larger than a state level. So if you want to know your neighborhood, whether or not they are vulnerable to heat, there's no such a public available information. nationwide for each sensor tract. So that's why we think about, okay, maybe we can do something from the vulnerability perspective based on the information we know which factor is associated with the heat vulnerability. We learned from a lot of our epidemiological studies that elderly people have low income, people, unfortunately, the minorities, Black, Hispanic, are also associated with high risks. So we combine all these data. Like we have the, for example, the satellite based the land surface temperature, and use that to estimate the air temperature level. And then we use the grid space or land, different land use types. So we combine all these indicators together to create this, what we call the heat vulnerability index. So we've been able to provide about 2/3 of all the census tracts in the U.S. We published that paper, but we don't want that paper just be in the journal that nobody can read. So we created what we call an online interactive tool. So we provide that online map that you can just click on the map, put your zip code, put your city, town name. You could find out how vulnerable your neighborhood is. I would provide a ranking of the neighborhood, whether or not compared to the, all the other census tracts in the state or in the whole nation, what is ranking. So you know in your state, in your neighborhood, which area is the most vulnerable. And then we, based on that data, we also did some analysis to see, for example, historically there's a policy called redlining. And some neighborhoods, the category D, the redlined neighborhoods compared with other neighborhoods, they unfortunately have a much higher vulnerability to heat. So that just reveals the historical residential disparities in the heat vulnerability.
Wow, that's really cool. And the interactive social tool sounds like a great way to create that kind of social awareness that's beyond the academic space. And a recent study that you were looking at also looked at disparities in cardiovascular mortality burden and how that's related to air pollution. That was really interesting too. Could you tell us more about what you found?
Yes. So we know air pollution is bad for our health, for cardiovascular health, for a long time. And because of that, the U.S. has the Clean Air Act, which is tremendously successful and has been a role model for many countries to follow in reducing the air pollution levels. So we see air pollution level from 2000 to 2016 has, in most of the places in the U.S., has dropped. So it's a successful, it's a good story, right? So we know air pollution is linked to cardiovascular health, so we can expect air pollution related to cardiovascular mortality. It has been decreased in the past decades in the U.S. So that's all good, all successful. But then we want to look at, because these are kind of disparities across different racial ethnic groups, we were asking a question, does this benefit of air pollution reduction have an equal distribution across different race ethnic groups? Why we're asking? Because we know minority groups, Black people, Hispanic, they tend to have high exposure to it. They may be close to the highway or close to the polluting sites. So we know they have high exposure, but we don't know whether or not they have a high benefits from their reduction. So we did a study first to look at it, the what we call, if you have air pollution exposure, what's the health risk? So that kind of relationship is called what we call exposure and a response relationship. Mm-hmm. So previously people will be doing this kind of analysis, they will just assume total population. So you have the reduction, you have the total, the exposure response function for the total population. Then you will estimate the burden overall. But we want to see are different, the racial ethnic groups have different exposure response function. So in other words, are certain racial ethnic groups more vulnerable to the air pollution? Because even with the same unit or same exposure level, some minority groups may have different responses. And we we found that turns out to be true. Unfortunately, black group, non-Hispanic black tend to be have higher risks when they're facing even the same level of exposure. So what does that mean? That means historically, because they have high exposure, high vulnerability, so they have much higher burden to air pollution related cardiovascular mortality burden. A good story is because they have the highest burden and we have air pollution reduction, so they have also a large reduction. However, if we look at the air pollution related mortality burden in the black group relative to white group, so what we call the relative scale disparity, you calculate the ratio in 2000, and then you can calculate the ratio when air pollution reduces until 2016. Unfortunately, we see the relative ratio of these black people's air pollution-related mortality burden versus the white, that ratio keeps consistent. Despite the fact air pollution has reduced, the absolute value of the mortality burden in both black and white has been reduced, that ratio keeps almost consistent, which tells us, although the current policy is very successful in reducing the pollution overall for everyone, but because black and Hispanic people are more vulnerable, they suffer more air pollution, so relatively speaking, their disparity is not reduced. So to move forward, we are actually needing some more dedicated efforts to try to reduce more exposure to these groups.
Wow, that's really interesting that the relative mortality doesn't fall away. That suggests that there's more work that's required there. And of course, we're also talking about global studies and kind of the big impacts and also these disproportionate impacts. This work is really, really important to try and ensure that these problems come to light. But do you think that healthcare systems are currently doing an adequate job to address these problems, or where do you think they could do a better job? Where do you think that the current gaps are in the way that the healthcare system is addressing them?
So I'm not claiming an expert on the healthcare system. We have a wonderful expert in the Yale Center on Climate and Health, Dr. Judy Sherman. She's an expert in the healthcare mitigation to reducing carbon emission. So what I have learned from her work is that the healthcare system itself is a big greenhouse gas emission contributor. And as such, that we need some sustainability efforts to reduce the healthcare system itself. So to do no harm to the planet health, do no harm to the culture of health. So that's one piece. But on the other hand, I want to argue that the actions that the society take to reduce the greenhouse gas emission, mitigate climate change, really needs everyone's efforts. And physicians and clinicians are actually have a unique position because they are the trusted voices in the society. They're trusted voices to the patients. So they are in a unique position to better educate their peers, their patients, to kind of motivate them to address contamination. So that goes from all the way, some individual level action, but also more collectively as a society, as a community, how to move forward with sustainable and healthier future with clean energy, face away from the fossil fuel, et cetera. So these collective efforts need to, clinicians, doctors, physicians, they can really play a major role in moving that.
Absolutely. That is so important. Thank you so much. We're heading towards our last few questions here, but we wanted to ask you about where you think the field of research on climate change and health is heading. So just looking a little bit into the future.
So this is a very good question. So I think this field, what I call now climate change epidemiology, it's a relatively emerging young field, but as because nature is a multidisciplinary field. So it bridges the discipline from climate sciences, environmental health sciences, exposure, statistics, biostatistics, epidemiology, different subcategories of medicine, internal medicine, and et cetera. So because the nature is a multidisciplinary, so the future lies in that multidisciplinary. So advances in each discipline will be the field future. For example, in climate sciences, there'll be emerging usage of what we call the sub-seasonal forecast. Imagine we can now do not only a few days weather forecast, but can do seasonal or a few months ahead. It can tell you, well, for example, now it's March. How about if we can get us early warning system happening this summer, which place are going to be very, very hot? You need to take precautions. If you don't have air conditioning, all the things, you need to consider that. Don't wait until you are in the middle of a heat wave to buy air conditioning, right? So these are the things potential in the future. But there's also, I can talk a lot about the skills in the climate science, for example, the attribution sciences are getting more and more advanced to quickly tell you the extreme, for example, if you have Wi-Fi events, they can quickly turn out to tell you how much a role climate change plays. And then we can calculate how much of the health burden is due to climate change, right? So these are all the advances in climate sciences. But in terms of epidemiology, we know that causal inference is the trend. We are embracing it. So how do we utilize all the causal inference approaches to quantify actually a certain things like, does heat warning system really work, right? If we take certain actions like planting more trees, would that actually work? Or if we shut down a coal power plant, shutting down the coal power plant actually will bring health benefits? So these are the things happening in the future field. There are also other advances in the medicine, which I'm sure you are all more familiar with me than me, but I think these advances are what we can grasp. And last but least, as we all know, that we are in the AI age, the AI, how to, you know, leverage that advances, leverage the algorithm, the computing power increases to better advance, not just for the research, but also can transform what we know from the findings to the clinician, to the clinical practices, to the public health policies, to the community preparedness. I think that is the future.
That is really exciting. And it sounds like it's all around us already and will become more and more apparent as time goes on. And so for our listeners, what do you think the best way is to get involved in similar research? And what is the part of what you do that is the most exciting to you?
Thanks. So I think for the listener, my only suggestion is, as I always tell my students, undergrad students, or master students who want to work with me, I think the first thing is ask which area, which topic that you're most excited about. I have students come to tell me that they're very excited to learn more about Wi-Fi smoke. So how does Wi-Fi actually lead to health effects? And we have tons of students coming here to say, well, we don't know much about the heat and Wi-Fi and all the other extreme events combined effects. So can we do something about it? So I think look at the literature and find out the topic that you're most motivated. And then we can find out the masses of data that can work out. So I think finding where your passion lies, that motivates you most, that's the suggestion. And for me personally, I share the story why I entered this field. I think one of the things I get most excited about is the opportunity to reveal the hidden burden or the full cost of climate change. Because what we know right now, these single pieces are really just the tips of iceberg. And we want to be able to reveal the full cost so that it can be factored into the policy decisions. But in the same time, as say about the movie Titanic, if you see the tip of the iceberg, it means maybe probably it's very late. You should really change your course, right? Change your direction. So we want to also try to find a way to provide the evidence-based guidelines for how can we transition? How can we change the direction, right? So these are things that motivates me.
Thank you for sharing your story, and that's excellent advice. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing all of your insights on the health impacts of climate change. I've learned so much that I wasn't personally aware of, and I think that our listeners will definitely be able to relate to that. So thank you.
Thank you so much. It's my great pleasure.
This was Dr. Chen with us on the YJBM podcast. I'm your host, Shivani, and until next time,